Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
So much has changed in the 20 years since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and policing is one of them. For one, police have more military equipment now. Case in point, Chicago Heights, Illinois, recently abolished its park police force and discovered the department had access to M16 rifles. In disbelief, the mayor of this suburban town said, "I don't see any reason why a part-time park district officer would need that type of arsenal." Washington Post opinion columnist Ratley Balco has been examining policing over the last 20 years. He's the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop. And recently updated version of his book is available, which examines policing through the January 6th Capitol Hill riot. And Ratley joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. Park police with M16s. And residents say they weren't told about this. Is that unusual?
No, it's not unusual. This kind of predates September 11th. It goes back to kind of the Reagan era drug war. But we have seen militarization of police departments across the country, including in, you know, pretty small towns. One program gives them surplus military equipment from the Pentagon. And that started sort of informally during the Reagan administration and then formally through a law Congress passed in the 90s. But it was really September 11th and the Department of Homeland Security that really kind of ramped up the effort to militarize the police.
And what are some of the ways that, we saw that ramp up of police militarization after 9/11?
One of the chief ways we've seen it is through DHS grants, these anti-terror grants to police departments across the country to buy new military-grade equipment. These grants really dwarf even the Pentagon surplus program. And because they go to purchase new equipment, new gear, instead of, you know, giving police departments surplus gear that's been sitting in a warehouse somewhere, they've created a cottage industry of companies that now exist to cash these DHS checks in exchange for armored personnel carriers, armored trucks, ballistics gear and all of that. There hasn't been a lot of scrutiny about whether the places that are receiving this equipment are actual terror threats. So you see them going to places like Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and cities in Idaho, Ohio, and in towns in the suburbs.
We understand that we saw this increase in gear. Was it also mindset as well? Has that shifted or changed, the idea of the purpose of police in cities and towns throughout the country with this military equipment?
Yeah, so I think these two things go together. Though a lot of this gear was supposed to be used to prevent terror attacks, once these police departments get it, they tend to use it for more mundane kind of everyday policing. And, you know, when you take a police officer and you dress him or her like a soldier, you train him like a soldier, you arm him like a soldier, and then you tell him he's fighting a war, whether it's a war on, you know, drugs or crime or terror, that police officer is going to start to see himself like a soldier, or at least some of them are. And that's not really a mentality that we want in domestic policing.
This conversation came up for us during the social justice protests, where we saw flashbang grenades to stun protesters and sometimes helicopters for crowd control. That's been happening for decades. Beyond those types of things, what are the costs, not only financially, but what this type of outfitting says to communities and relationships with communities and police?
Yeah, well, I think it makes communities distrustful of police. So you see it, you know, not just in police brutality or police shootings that, you know, could have been prevented. You see it also in a breakdown in kind of trust between police and the communities where these types of tactics and gear are used. And so, you know, we see things like really low homicide clearance rates, because when you don't have the trust and cooperation of the community, when they fear the police more than they fear the criminals, it becomes more difficult to solve crimes.
You referenced the footprints of this long before 9/11. In 1997, the Clinton administration implemented the 1033 program, which you referenced, which was the surplus program. And that operates in all but one state. It has been a political football since 9/11, with President Obama restricting it and President Trump then rescinding those restrictions. What's the status of it now?
So it is back. President Trump removed the restrictions that the Obama administration had instituted. And, you know, I will say, I mean, the Obama administration, I think, deserves credit for being the first administration really ever to at least acknowledge that militarization of police is a problem. But the restrictions that the Obama administration put on the 1033 program, this Pentagon surplus program, were really mostly symbolic. By the time that those restrictions were put on after Ferguson, a lot of police departments had already moved to other ways of getting this kind of gear.
20 years after 9/11, we're really at a point where we're doing pretty deep reflection of who we are as Americans, what changes we've seen over the last 20 years. Is there any indication that the militarization of police has overall increased public safety?
I don't think so. I mean, that's a really difficult thing to measure. There have been some studies that have tried to quantify that, and they've come down all over the place. You know, crime went down dramatically for most of the last 20 years. It did go up pretty significantly last year, but that was after about a 20-year decline. And of course, last year we had, you know, a pandemic and protests and all sorts of other sort of civil unrest going on. I think the number of rogue police officers is probably a lot smaller than it used to be. And I think that police departments have gotten better. Those, you know, still significantly lacking in some parts of the country, but they've at least gotten better at holding officers who violate policy and who violate the law are more likely to be accountable than they used to be. The problem is, I think, that the amount of force that police are allowed to use as a matter of policy, as a matter of law, has increased. We've become more comfortable, just because it's happening more, with, for example, using SWAT teams to enforce search warrants for pretty low-level drug crimes. We've seen SWAT teams be used to enforce regulatory code, even things like, you know, bars, you know, serving underage people, fraternities where there's underage drinking going on. And that, I think, is something that definitely has changed and that we should be, you know, pretty wary of.
You know, going back to what I was asking you about relationships with community and police relationships with community, do you think the defund the police movement is a natural outgrowth of this increased militarization? I mean, we ask because activists are protesting police violence against people of color, not increased militarization. What trends are you noticing there?
Well, I think the violence, you know, goes hand in hand with the militarization, right? When you see yourself as a soldier and you see the people you're supposed to be serving and protecting as not as citizens with rights, but as a potential threat, that's going to lead to more violence. Right? You're going to be more sort of wary. But then an interesting thing happened. I think during the George Floyd protests, we saw dramatic movement in the polls on issues like whether people support Black Lives Matter, whether they believe that in institutional racism, whether they believe that police officers disproportionately stop or use force against people of color.
Yeah. With that, I mean, do you see a turning back of the tide in any way in the outfitting of police overall, of military style weapons? And I guess we are seeing a difference in the sense of mindset, but where do you see us heading?
I was cautiously optimistic after the George Floyd protests. And we are seeing, again, significant reform at the local level. As far as the federal level, Congress is just so far behind the rest of the country on a lot of these issues, and they're so risk-averse. I'm not an abolitionist. I think we do need police officers. We need people to solve crimes and arrest dangerous people. But, you know, we could also shrink the police footprint pretty dramatically. We could get police out of traffic enforcement, which is completely unnecessary and creates a lot of confrontation and mistrust. We could get police out of schools. So, you know, whether you're an abolitionist or a person who thinks we should, you know, double the funding of police, what we do all want is a safer community without police officers who are, you know, violating the rights of the people who live in those communities, especially the most vulnerable people. And that's, I think, is really the discussion that we need to have.
That's Washington Post opinion columnist Ratlee Balko, who has updated his 2014 book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, to examine policing through the January 6th Capitol Hill riot.